I was going to speak this afternoon, didn't I? Anyhow, I didn't mean any offense to anybody, but hopefully, as we've been going through and proceeding through this story of Abraham, starting out as Abram and moving on into the name Abram, which we discussed a little bit last night, even though we didn't get to it yet in the process of the story. But we did talk about a little bit about the alphabet, of the Hebrew alphabet, and Psalm 119, and how each one has a stanza that is represented by one of the letters of the alphabet. And one of the things that we've been talking about is the term Bethel. Bethel means house of God. And when we talked about each letter of the alphabet, the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet is Beth. Alphabet. Alphabet. Aleph Beth is the alphabet. That's what we use in the English language, and we call it the alphabet, just the letters of the alphabet of the English language. Well, the Aleph Beth is where that comes from, and that's the first two letters of the Hebrew language. But the Beth has a pictograph. I said each one of these letters have a pictograph. The pictograph for the letter Beth is a house. So you have the word Beth and then El. Bethel. El in Hebrew is God. So it's the house of God. There are many other words that we use. The ending of a Hebrew word in I am, like Elohim, is adding a plural to it. You have the term Ur. It's U-R in English. We would spell it U-R, capital U, and then R. But it means, in Hebrew, it means light. So the Urim and the Thummim were two things that were put in the high priest's breastplate. That is how they determined. And that actually means the lights. Urim is plural, the lights. And then Thummim is the perfections. Truth is how it comes about, through light. And there's a lot of different things about the Hebrew language that's very interesting as you proceed through this. And that's why I said, with some of the things about the cities, even, as you see where this progresses to in the life of Abram. First of all, he's in the land of Ur. We just talked about what Ur is. It's light. And where that is down in the Mesopotamia area, very close to, not far from where Babylon was established, but it's also been notified by a lot of people that that is actually the land of where Eden, the garden was, the garden of God. And so if he's being drawn out of that, it's also called now the land of the Chaldeans, which is the astrologers, not the astronomers. The astrologers, there's a difference. And the astrologers were the ones that were the magic men, if you recall, from the land of Babylon. Well, they go from the land of Ur, light, all the way to Haran. And that's where Terah goes with Lot and Sarai and Abram. And they go to Haran, and that's where the family is, and that's where Abram was called out of. Haran means parched, and it comes from this term to burn, or to incite passion, or to be angry. So God calls Abram out of this particular land into a land that he's going to show him, and he goes into Canaan. And Canaan is the land of the merchant, or trafficking, and Ted brought that up. That it's interesting how the Canaanite was the land of an individual that was a trafficker. And what was Satan doing? He was trafficking. We read a lot about that in Ezekiel chapter 28 and also in Isaiah 14. But by his merchandise, and what does Satan merchandise in now? False religion is what he really merchandises in. Anyhow, if you recall, Abram goes to a place called Bethel. to worship. Because what do you do at the house of God? You worship. We just explained what Bethel meant. From there, he moved to Hebron. And in Hebron, the word means fellowship or communion. And that's where he starts to commune with God. God talks to Abram. God shows him things. He tells him a little bit more about the plan that he has for him. And then finally, as we find out, we're going to come to another part where Abram ends up in the process. But I thought that was interesting because a lot of it is very symbolic of showing the whole plan and process of where God is taking humanity, coming from the Garden of Eden all the way to this idea of now there's a land that's parched and dry. There's no God there. God calls the individuals out into a different land. It's still in the world. It's still an area where we have to deal with all of these demonic creatures that are acting through human representatives until finally we get to a point where Abram's going to end up in the story. In chapter 16, if we continue on this, we talked last night that after so long a time, all these promises that God made to Abram in the first verse of chapter 12 have not yet happened. And he starts to question God. And after that, he produces this sacrifice of these different animals. We talked about the sacrifice a little bit, about some of those things. And I just want to backtrack a little because I think it's important. There are a couple of things that happened. If you recall, the sacrifice was divided, laid out. And in verse 10 of chapter 15, he took all these things, divided them one against another, laid them one piece against another. And then in verse 11, and the fowls came down upon the carcasses, and Abram had to drive them away. And the fowls here represent evil spirits. So we can see that even in the sacrifices that we make, we have to drive away all the demonic activity out of our life, because we've mentioned the fact that we are supposed to be living sacrifices. And when that happens, a lot of times our communion with God, our worship of God is interrupted, and we have to drive them away. In verse 12, then their sun came down, was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And lo, there was great darkness that fell upon him. And what happens a lot of times in life is great darkness represents trials and tests of life. And when that happens, a lot of times it takes our mind off of what we're really trying to do and accomplish as far as our communion with God, our worship of God, our sacrifice to God. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you, O Lord. That was one of the cries of David in the Psalms. That's a sacrifice. So these are the things that was happening in that particular process. But Abram was learning all through this to trust God more and more. We come to chapter 16. In verse 1 it says, and Sarai, Abram's wife, bare no children. And she had a handmaid, who was an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. So Sarai could not produce children of the promised seed after 10 years of being in the land of Canaan and going through all that they had already done. Abraham still living by what he sees. Even though God promised him all these things, that he was going to have a seed, he was going to be blessed, and a nation was going to come out of him, and all these things, he still does not have a child. He has no heir. There's no promised seed. But really, he has not completely come to the point where he has died to the self. And he proceeds then to listen to his wife, Sarai, who tells him, what? Take my handmaid. We can have a child through her. So even though the spiritual man bears no fruit through the promised woman, he is going back to the law. In essence, he's going back to Hagar, who was not of the promised seed. Abraham remains without seed according to the promise until he does one thing. He dies to himself and his self-will. And that's where he has to be considered dead physically. And to understand that, turn over to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 is a chapter on faith. And there's something that, you know, about the chapter of faith, it's interesting because we talked about the progression of the, I had it on board last night, the natural man, the spiritual man, and then the man of faith. Well, the man of faith has to grow into that position. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 12 says, therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead. Abram was now 99 years old in this particular section, but he was 100 years old when Isaac was conceived of Sarai, or Sarah at that time. And as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky, a multitude, and as the sand of the seashore, and is innumerable. But these were the things that were promised to him. If you backtrack up into verse 11, it says, through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Because the promise then comes to Sarai, as we see, after her name is changed. So he was considered as good as dead. He was considered, and so was Sarai, barren and unable to produce children. But he does so. What does Romans chapter 6 talk about? Romans chapter 6 speaks to this fact about the law. When the spiritual man tries to go back into and deal with the law, it does produce fruit. Romans 6 and verse 6. Knowing this, that our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed, that henceforth we should not serve sin. And then verse 21. What fruit had you then in those things whereof you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. The only thing that the law can produce, the only thing that can happen when a spiritual man goes back and crosses the line and delves back into this world and the ways of the world, the natural man, the thing that happens is death. But we know that Christ has conquered death, and that's why we talk about that, that the law has no effect on us, because we look at Christ. But anyhow, what we're dealing with here is that Abram goes back and he conceives a child with Hagar. And Sarai blames herself for that too as well. And they try to get rid of Hagar and the child. And some things happen. God talks to her and says, well, you go back there and just submit yourself. In verse 9 of chapter 16, it says, then the angel of the Lord said to her, return unto your mistress and submit yourself into her hands. Because he was going to bless and provide for Ishmael as well. Verse 11, it says, and the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. And Ishmael means God shall hear. And he shall be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of his brothers. And she called the name of the Lord, that spoke to her, you, God, see me. For she had said, I also am here, looked after him that sees me. So there's some words that are used here. And then Hagar bore Abram a son in verse 15. And Abram called his son's his son's name, which Hagar bore him Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. So Abram left Haran when he was 75. He's now 86, and he has Ishmael. So there's 11 years that have passed. And then in chapter 17, Abram's now 99. And the Lord appeared to him, said, "I'm the Lord, Almighty God. Walk before me, be perfect. I will make my covenant between you, me and you, and multiply your seed exceedingly." Abraham fell on his face and talked with him, saying, "Behold, my covenant, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you. You shall be a father of many nations, a multitude of nations." Now he increases this covenant once again. "Neither shall any more your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham. For a father of many nations have I made you." And then over in verse 15, he also states that, "And God said to Abram, as for your wife, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name." And her name was changed from princess to noble woman. She was elevated to a status of nobility at that point by God. And we talked about this last night with the Hebrew letters, the letter H, the He, the fifth letter of the alphabet. It also talks about teaching, but it's the breath of God that's added. And we went to chapter 20 of John, talked about when Christ said to his disciples, "Receive the Holy Spirit," he breathed on them. And this is the idea that the Spirit is coming upon not only Sarai, but Abram. Now their name is changed because the letter H is added to each one of their names. So the Spirit has come upon them at this point in chapter 17, when he has already been dealing with the law through Hagar, and he found out that through all of that, that's not what he is supposed to be doing, because he's still dealing with the self-will instead of dealing with God's will and totally devoting that through faith. So chapter 17, after 13 years, Ishmael is born. Abram's 99. God appears to him and communicates with him. And then he talks to him about the covenant of circumcision. Covenant of circumcision is supposed to be for a newborn 8 days old. What's number eight?
Beginning.
New beginnings. Regeneration. New life. That's the number eight. It's talking about all of that. There's many things about the number eight that's very interesting. And even when you get into the holy days, as we mentioned, they're listed in Leviticus chapter 23. The eighth day is the last day as far as the Hebrew holy days are concerned. But the eighth day is a very interesting day in and of itself, because it's the eighth day, the number of regeneration, the number of new life. It's a resurrection is what it is. So what this eighth, the circumcision, was doing for Abram in that particular instance was giving him a new life. It was resurrecting his old body that, as in Hebrews it said, was as good as dead. It's resurrecting him so that he can now produce children. True circumcision, as we know, is that of the heart, giving up the fleshly confidence. Rick, could you do me a favor and turn over to Philippians chapter 3 and read verses 3 through 10 for us?
Philippians 3, verses 3 through 10. "For we are the circumcision which worship God in the Spirit, and rejoice in Christ Jesus, and have no confidence in the flesh. Though I might also have confidence in the flesh, if any other man thinks that he has whereof, he must trust in the flesh, I more. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, and Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law of Pharisee. concerning zeal, persecuting the church, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. But what things were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and do count them but dung, that I may win Christ. One more, okay. And be found in him, not having mine own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the righteousness which is of God by faith, that I may know him, and the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death.
You can see how this is tied directly into what was going on with Abram and the message of circumcision with that particular episode. New life was given to Abram at that time. He changed his name to Abraham. A new life in the spirit. Now he is starting to become that, not just a spiritual man, but a man of faith. He's learning more and more as this goes on. Paul's desire was to know Christ, the power with which he was raised from the dead, the fellowship of his sufferings, and being made conformable unto his death, which was the death of the self. Christ said, I came to do your will. Genesis chapter 17 and verse 23. You'll see what happens. Genesis chapter 17 and verse 23. Go back there. In the process, what does Abram do? Immediately, Abram took Ishmael his son and all that were born in his house. Now Ishmael's 13 years old at the time. And all that were bought with money, every male among them of Abraham's house, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskin the selfsame day as God had said unto him. There was no procrastination, no hesitation. He said the selfsame day, that's it. God made this promise to me. He's going to grant me to be a father of many nations. This is what's going to happen. He told me this is a requirement. All males that were born should be on the eighth day, but everybody in the house, no matter how old they were, they got circumcised that particular day. And Abram was 99 years old when he circumcised the flesh of his foreskin. Ishmael, his son, was 13 years old and was circumcised. And the selfsame day was Abram circumcised with Ishmael, his son, and all the men in his household. So it's emphasized over and over and again that this is why this idea of circumcision without the Israel nation was so important. It was a covenant that was made with them and God. That's what they felt because they were the children of Abraham and they observed this over and over, the circumcision on the eighth day. And matter of fact, if there was somebody that was a stranger in their land and they proclaimed that they were of Israel, they would actually make them drop their drawers and prove it. That's how serious they took this particular covenant. And there's a lot more we can say about circumcision, but I just wanted to bring that into the fact that that's the part that new life is given, the idea that Abram now has received the Spirit through God changing his name, and he is now Abraham instead of Abram, and he's dealing with a different thing now. Then there's something that interrupts this again. We talked about all these interruptions from the world coming back in. After the promised seed, Isaac, comes, something happens, but Isaac is promised in chapter 18. The Lord appears to Abram in the plains of Mamre, and he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. And you understand that there's some things that are going on in these two different chapters, chapter 18 and chapter 19. Chapter 18 is something where God or the celestial visitors come to Abram. And then in chapter 19, some celestial visitors come to visit Lot. And remember, we talked about Lot And I didn't mention this. Lot's name means veiled, covering. So the individuals, we talked about this even at lunch, individuals have this idea in the world, there's a veil, there's a covering over them. They cannot comprehend what God's doing, what he's working out. They can't see God. They don't have a relationship with him in the same way that Abram does. So, now Abraham. But Lot, his name means he's veiled, and he represents that individual that sort of is in contact with a spiritual man, but he lives and dwells in the world, as we had stated. When he was given the opportunity to select where he wanted to have his herds and where he wanted to live, because the herdsmen of Abram and Lot were at feud or at odds, and there was strife between them, Lot chose the area that was familiar with him. It was the lush pastures, but it also entailed the city of Sodom. And that's where chapter 19 and chapter 18 come into a play here. So what you have here, after the promised seed, Isaac comes, after the promised seed, Isaac comes, the end of Lot, then with the destruction of Sodom, happens, even though Isaac is not yet born. Abraham, now a man of faith, with a new name and a circumcised heart, God's spirit is at rest in his tent, judging himself. He's not judging the rest of the world as we know Lot did, because Lot was considered a judge. He was at the gates of the city. So you have chapter 18 and 19. 18 is Abraham and his tent in the heat of the day. And then you have Lot, and he's in the city gate. And what do you do at a city gate? When these visitors come, what do you do at a city gate? You are a judge. Lot was a judge of the city of Sodom. First of all, he's a natural man in the gate of the city, seeking to judge others with correction. This judgment that he has is a downward correction. Can a person like Lot change anyone else in this world? No. I mean, we can't even change anybody. We talk about preaching the gospel. We can't change them. Preach the gospel everywhere. If necessary, use words. The best thing you can do is live by example. But Lot's example wasn't going to change anything. Talk about a bad apple in a barrel and it's going to infect the rest of the apples. Well, if you put a good apple in a barrel that's bad, it's not going to change anything. Those bad apples are still going to remain bad. Matter of fact, they're going to have more effect on the good apple than he will on them. So, nevertheless, that's what happens, though. Individuals that have a little bit of knowledge about God, they go out into the world and they try to change people over and over and over, and all they do is get burned. So I want to do a comparison here. Chapter 18, you have Abram sitting at his tent, and you'll notice that the tent is a place of relaxation. It's in the heat of the day. He's at rest. And what does he do as soon as this happens? He says, stay with me. Tells the visitor, stay with me. Don't go anywhere. And he ran. There's a guy that's 99 years old. Gets up and he runs to prepare a meal for them. And the meal is, he gets Sarai, his wife, Sarah, now, his wife, said, quick, get some flour, bake some bread. We got bread, butter, milk, and a calf. A young, tender calf. So he's got a really nice steak dinner. He's got bread and butter and milk. But this took time. This didn't happen, okay, we're going to go over to the refrigerator. We're going to pull out a steak that we already have bought from Publix or whatever the grocery store is down here. And we're going to go throw it on the grill real quick. No, it takes time to take a calf, dress it, prepare it, cook it. It takes time to take flour, knead it into bread, and then bake it. This is something that took time. There was a lot of time to commune while this meal is happening. What happens with Lot in chapter 19? It's at the evening of the day. Lot is visited by his celestial beings. It's at the gate of Sodom. He says, come to my house, wash your feet, stay the night, but rise early and get out of here. Because he knew the city was not good, especially for these individuals. And what does he do? Performs and he prepares a meal for them, unleavened bread, and that was it. Now, what do you know about unleavened bread? What did the Israelites had to do when they left Egypt? It was unleavened bread. What is unleavened bread? They don't have time for the dough to rise into a bread, a loaf of bread. It's quick. It's in a hurry. He just wants to feed them and get them out of here. So you can see the difference in the two men. Then there's this idea of prayer. Because you can see what Abram does when he prays for them. But the man of faith communes with God naturally, without any effort. And it's in peace. It's by the door of his tent. He's communing with them. Prayer for the natural man, Lot, is communication, is a struggle. It's hurried. It's oftentimes interrupted. Because when the men were in the house of Lot, what was happening? The men of the city were pounding on the door. They wanted him to let those angels or those celestial creatures out so they could have their way with them. And Lot does something totally different than what Abraham would do. But this is the idea of giving. And when you're communing with God, 2 Corinthians chapter 9. 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Verse 7 and 8. Talks about giving. Every man according as he has purposed in his heart, so let him give. Not grudgingly or of obligation, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace, all favor abound toward you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. These are the things that a cheerful giver will do. Somebody that is taking time, has communion with God. It's not something where he's tightly holding on to. In our world today, it would be money. And there's a reason why they call money currency. Currency has to be a current that flows. It can't be something you try to hold on to. It's like damming up a creek. You're going to end up with something where it's going to spill over and it's eventually going to flood and hurt other people. You can't control it like that. A cheerful giver is somebody that is doing it not grudgingly, not out of obligation, but because they really have it in their heart. Everything that God has done for us, God so loved the world that he gave. That love in action is giving. He loved the world that he gave his son. Willingly, and Christ willingly gave himself as an offering. And that's why Christ said that before. That's why the offering of the burnt offering is called a free will offering. It's not, wasn't an obligation. The first three offerings were all obligation, not obligatory at all. It was something that was done from the heart of the giver because they wanted to commune with God. They wanted to know God and to sacrifice. Back in the Old Testament, meant a lot. Especially if you were giving a burnt offering, you were taking one of your cows or one of your sheep and you were killing that animal and then burning it all up to God as an offering. You didn't partake, you didn't eat any of that. That was all burnt up on the altar. That was all for God. That was what a burnt offering was. So this is the idea. Sacrifice costs something and we should do it cheerfully and willingly. Well, that's not what was happening with Lot and Abraham here. Lot was very grudgingly doing what he had to do because he wanted to get rid of them right away. Anytime that you have, and we talked about this last night too, the natural man, when he comes in contact with anything that's spiritual, he feels very uneasy. He's very uncomfortable with this situation. He wants it to be over as soon as possible. And you can see it when sometimes people of the world go across even a street preacher. The guy's handing out tracts on a corner. They just want to run away or cross the street. They don't want anything to do with this person. Well, then later on, you can see in the process, in chapter 18, Abraham prays for the world to be spared. This is the idea of it. He's not just praying for the town of Sodom, but he's representative of the world. He's saying, Lord, will you save, will you spare the city for 50 people? In other words, if you can even find 50 people in that city, will you save everybody? Will you spare them all? Sure, I'll spare everybody for 50. Then he starts to negotiate a little bit more. He's getting more intimate with his prayer because he knows, you know, God has promised me all these things. Now I have a communion with him. I can communicate with him back. What about for 45? Yeah, okay, 45. How about 40? How about 30? 20? Sure, I'll do it for 20. How about 10? Okay. I'll spare everyone for 10 righteous people. And we know the story. Couldn't even find 10. What did Lot want to do as far as that? An offering. He wanted to offer his two virgin daughters to the men outside. That's what he wanted to do. Here's my offering. My two virgin daughters. What kind of person would do that? And then we come to the end of Lot. He actually has to be grabbed by the hand. Him and his wife, one angel, one visitor, and then the other visitor grabbed each one of his daughters, the two virgins that he was willing to give away to the men of the city. And they had to be pulled out. They'd be dragged out of there. And his wife looks back and turns into a pillar of salt. Now, Rick and I have been talking about that. Rick asked a question one time at one of our Zoom studies about pillar of salt. What does that actually mean? I would liken it to studying this out. You can have your own ideas on it. This is my thought. I picture the destruction of Sodom because when you understand what happened in there, what rained down on Sodom was brimstone. Chapter 19, verse 24. And the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. What was brimstone? Where do you find brimstone? Chapter 20, Revelation. Brimstone was a touchstone. It was something that was to declare whether something was pure or not. This is the idea of the lake of fire. It's the same thing. Fire came down upon Sodom and Gomorrah as representative of the lake of fire that was to come. Now, what is salt and what is a pillar? Salt is something that purifies. So if she's turned into a pillar of salt, she's actually being purified because Lot's wife looked back to the city. So I know it may not answer everybody's questions, but salt is good for a lot of things. They use salt to salt a baby when they're first born. Phil brought that out. I think it's Ezekiel chapter 16. They talk about that when Israel was born. And that was not something that we do today, but it was something to clean off the baby and purify it and get rid of any bacteria or things like that. It would rub salt on it, also to harden up the skin. There's gargling with salt water. is very good for a sore throat. It relieves a lot of bacteria and infections. There's other things to do. There's a covenant of salt. The covenant of salt is for long duration. It's something that was supposed to be permanent in essence, that was going to last. So salt, you've heard the phrase, he's worth his weight in salt. Salt was such an important ingredient back in the days of the Roman Empire, for example. They used to pay a Roman soldier in salt, because salt could do a lot of things. Cleanse a wound, purify things, could actually preserve food and meat. And so you could take a look at the fire that was raining down upon Sodom as a judgment. That's a lake of fire. It's a judgment. And what happens for the lake of fire is the purification of individuals. And I believe that's what was really going on with Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt. Anyhow, Lot ends up in a mountain where his daughters get him drunk and end up with children, Moab and Ammon. And all throughout the rest of history, Moab and Ammon are a thorn in the side of Israel centuries later. So you have this whole idea, once again, that the natural man is constantly being a problem to the spiritual man, as Israel is God's firstborn being brought out of Egypt into the promised land. They're having problems once again with the children of Lot. So, and Rick mentioned this too, as well as Edom. They have problems with these groups of people. So it's always being brought back to this point. The spiritual man has to remove himself from that situation as much as possible. But what does that mean? Do we just forget about them? No, we have to act like Abram did, or Abraham. He prayed for them. He prayed for them very earnestly, trying to negotiate with God, trying to get them to come to a point where they would wake up. God, will you spare them? Well, what does it mean to spare them? He's going to actually spare them. He spared the world through his son. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 19, it states that the whole world lies in Satan's control. The world is on fire, even as we know today. Wars and rumors of wars, they're all over the place. We can't even get people to agree on anything, political parties or not. So what are we to do? And that's what we have to do as Abraham did. We have to pray for them. We have to remove ourselves from the situation as much as possible, not let it affect us. And sometimes, I'll tell you what, it's very easy to be affected by what's going on in this world. It can get us down. It can really, really get us into a state of depression if we follow it too much. But we have to understand, even as these men of faith in Hebrews chapter 11 said they looked for this city whose builder and maker was God. And they didn't receive those promises, but they knew it was something that was guaranteed. Bill talked about this verse, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 16 through 21. We don't view man after the flesh. We don't view any man after the flesh. We view men, in my opinion, we view men now for the potential that they have because of what God has already provided with his son. I always looked at the two processes. I started out yesterday, I talked about this idea of grace and peace. Paul was always telling the churches, grace and peace be to you. Grace is favor. His favor is poured upon a whole world by the sacrifice of his son, because it says he gave his only son for the world. God so loved the world. He didn't just love the Jews at that time. He didn't love Israel for the potential that they were going to come back into the land. He loved the world. That means Gentiles as well. As we can see all through the Old Testament, Gentiles were brought into the fold. And God also had a plan for the Gentiles, which we know today as the body of Christ. But he loved the world. He loves everybody. And it's not something that we should look at the rest of humanity as being something that's outside of God. I didn't even get to Isaac yet. Anyhow, verse 16 of 2 Corinthians chapter 5. In the Universal Version, which I like better than what was read earlier in the King James. So as we now know no man, no one according to the flesh, but even if we have known Messiah according to the flesh, because Paul's made a statement to some individuals that have known Christ when he walked on the earth, Paul didn't really have that opportunity. He knew him as a resurrected Savior. Yet now we know no longer him that way. So we don't view man after that way either. We view man after the potential for what they do have. So anyone who is in Messiah is a new creation. The archaic has passed away. Look, all becomes new. We talk about this regeneration. We're a new creation. New creation can only come about by a new birth. We have new birth. In verse 18, and all things are from Elohim. All things are from God, who has reconciled us to himself by Jesus Messiah and has given us the ministry of conciliation. Now, I've made statements in our Zoom studies. You have this idea of reconciliation. But before you have conciliation. And I broke this down into earlier, grace and peace, redemption and reconciliation. Peace is unification. That's reconciliation. Two opposing parties come together, have an agreement of peace. Redemption is the payment that was made to bring that reconciliation about. So before you can have reconciliation, you have conciliation. So the conciliation is redemption. That's the redemption that was offered by Christ. God offered his Son to redeem the world. That's why it says we look no longer at man after the flesh. Because the whole world has been redeemed. Now we can say it's been saved. There's different forms of salvation. You've been saved. You are being saved if you are a new creation. You are being saved. You're in the process of sanctification, if you want to call it that. And you will be saved. So you put it in different tenses, but you have been saved. You've been redeemed. You are in the process of being sanctified, and you will be saved. You will be reconciled totally upon the resurrection. That's when total unity with the Father comes. And that's why you take a look at Paul's gospel, and he uses this terminology all the time, talking about the churches. Grace and peace be to you. Because in the gospel, it's the death, the burial, and the resurrection. The death is the justification. That's the part where the sacrifices have been made. That's the payment that's been made. Death has no more claim on anyone. That's been done away because the resurrection of Christ nullifies the power of death. The power of death was people thought they'd never be born again, never be resurrected. There's a fear in that. What happens with Christ being raised from the dead? That's why they tried to cover that fact up so much. Pharisees went to the Roman soldiers and said, don't tell anyone this happened. Because they're going to say that they, we'll say that they stole the body. Because if they find out that this really is something that happened to Christ, man, our whole religion is shot. All the things that we did, we're done. So that's why this whole thing about the resurrection of Christ is so important. He's not a dead Savior. He's somebody that's living. But this goes on in here. We are to tell how Elohim was in Messiah, conciliating, redeeming the world to himself, not charging men's transgressions to their account, and that he has entrusted to us this communication, this message of redemption. That's what it says, it's conciliation, but it means redemption. That God has already done this. He's done it for everybody. And when we approach somebody that doesn't know him, say, you know, someday you will know. You will know that God has already done this for you. He loves you. He loves all of us. We're all his creation. Some are his children, and then some move into sonship. And there's a process even in that. In verse 19, we're able to tell how Elohim was in Messiah, conciliating the world to himself, redeeming the world to himself, not charging men's transgressions to their account, because what? The Son, he gave his Son as an offering. And that he has entrusted to us the communication of this conciliation, this message of the redemption. That's what we're supposed to be doing. You've been redeemed. You're saved. The whole world is saved. You just have to know this. Death has no more power over you. Now then, we are missionaries. We are messengers for Messiah, as though Elohim, whose God is making his plea through us. In other words, Christ isn't here anymore, but Christ is here in us, and we're supposed to be making this message known to everybody through us. As I said, you preach the gospel. The gospel is what? The grace of God. The grace is the redemption. So we're supposed to preach the redemption. If necessary, we use words. But as people see our walk, as people see that we're being sanctified, that's our walk, then they can ask us questions about that. We should be ready to give an answer. And this is the thing. Be conciliate. Be redeemed to Elohim. You already are. Now you need to know it. For the one who did not know sin, that's Christ, he was a blemish-free offering. On our behalf, God made him into a sin offering, an offering for sin. Because a blemish-free offering, if he was to take on sin, like it says in the King James Version, he became sin, that we, as a transference, that we could become the righteousness of him and God and all this stuff. It's not it. It's not correct. If he took on sin, if he became sin, then he's not a blemish-free. He's not a perfect offering anymore. And you know what the priests were reprimanded in Malachi for doing? Offering sacrifices to God that were filled with blemishes. The blind offering, the lame offering. That's not a blemish-free offering. And that's not what Christ was. Christ was not a blemished offering. He was blemish-free. He had no sin. So God made him into a sin offering because he's the only one that ever qualified to that. He never sinned, so he could be that offering. So then we are becoming the righteousness of God in him, in Christ. I could talk a lot about the story of Abram and Isaac, but I'll just mention a few things. It happens at Mount Moriah, and that's in Jerusalem. The name Jerusalem, we talked about the areas of where all of this flows to. There was Ur, to Haran, to Canaan, to Bethel, to Hebron, and Abram's life is progressing. Now he comes to Jerusalem to sacrifice his son, who at this age is 30 years old. This idea that in Christianity we have this idea that Isaac was a little boy. Isaac was 30 years old when Abram went to sacrifice him. So Isaac was fully on board with the fact that I was going to be a burnt offering. And to be a burnt offering at that time really meant something. If you want to study it out, what it meant was read Leviticus chapter 1. That's a burnt offering. And we talked about how Abram, early in his life, he was going through building an altar, offering burnt offerings. How Noah came off the ark, built an altar, offered burnt offering. Well, now Abraham is told to go and offer his son, the son that you love. And this all ties into the fact that God the Father offered his son, whom he loved, for a burnt offering on the cross at the same place where who? Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. The sacrifice was stopped. The angel said, don't lay a hand on the lad. I will provide the sacrifice. I will provide the lamb. A few thousand years later, the father did provide sacrifice. And that point of Abraham's life, where he comes to the idea of having such faith that all these promises that were made to him, that through Isaac, all these blessings would come to the world. Abram got to the point where he could believe that even if he sacrificed his son, that the promise that God made to bring salvation and a blessing to all of his creation was through Isaac, that God would also raise him from the dead. And that's why he could go through with that. And that's what Isaac had to believe as well. And that's why when you look at the typology that's involved with Christ offering his life, he said, I do it willingly. Isaac was willing to go through this process as well. So I hope that enlightens us a little bit to about the life of Abram and Abraham and Sarah. And there's much more that could be done with it, but I hope you got something out of it, enjoyed it as much as I did. in studying it. So, thanks a lot. Anyone want to say anything?
Yeah. Last night you pointed out, you know, you had the natural man, the spiritual man, man of faith. Would there be a better word than natural man? Because my concordant version has soulish.
Soulish would be a great one.
Yeah, because nature is always in line with God. That which is natural, natural affection, natural, right. You know, that which is contrary to nature is usually the bad thing.
No, so. That's good. I mean, you're getting more specific about the terminology, yeah. But sometimes the idea of soulish versus natural, some people just might not get that. The idea.
Yeah.
We understand what you mean by soulish man.
Exactly. But then wouldn't that give people the idea that natural is not a good thing if you, you know, making that point? Because that's not, man is not, the natural man, you know, the soulish man is not natural. You know, that he's defective. And we want to get to, you know, the more natural thing.
Well, the way that God intentionally originally created man. The natural man,
yeah,
so that they could progress to that process. But the soulish man is one that's
governed by his emotions, by his
yes,
yeah.
That's good.
You say Jacob, Isaac was a willing sacrifice. Do you have any direct evidence of that?
I go by typology. If Isaac. The offering of Isaac by Abram was typology of the father offering his son. Especially when you get to the point where you can see Abraham being tested all through his life. After that event, and he was willing to go through it, he said, now I know. God said to Abraham, now I know. After all the things you've been through. You went through Egypt. You lied about your wife being your sister. Well, it was a half-truth. But anyhow, all of these things that he did, you went and you had a child through the handmaid of your wife. Now I know, because you've got to this point. So I've used this analogy with typology, and typology can always be something that it's describing an individual and their character, their function, or their their character, their function. And it goes forward, but it also can look back, because the reality of what the type is supposed to show you, you can then look back at the type and say, now I see what was really being said. If Isaac was a type of Christ, which I think everybody can agree with, then Christ, when he said, no man takes my life, I give it And he said, I came to do your will to the Father.
But he negotiated with the Father with such an intensity that he could have died in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's where he yielded his will finally, right? And I think that matches the passage that you have here in verse 7 of 22. And Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father and said, My father, and he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?
Jesus knew it was coming, but Isaac didn't.
But from that point,
yeah, Isaac was, wait. He told him there would be a sacrifice. Now, Isaac didn't. He believed his father, but his father wasn't truthful with it at that point.
He knew there was going to be a sacrifice.
Yes.
Where is the sacrifice?
God will provide it.
Okay.
He says, Father, where's the sacrifice?
Okay.
He didn't say, You are the sacrifice.
But Abraham is, how old is he at this time? 130 years old.
But a very strong man.
Oh, okay.
I don't think he was feeble.
I don't think he was stronger than a 30-year-old man.
Could have been.
I don't think so. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You wouldn't have had to force him. Abraham went to sacrifice his son. No matter what time he found out about it, Isaac was very willing to do it.
Why did he get bound?
Why did he bind him?
Yeah.
You do with a sacrifice.
That's what you do with a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Do you really want to know what the sacrifice would have entailed for a priest to offer a burnt offering? Not only kill it, but then remove the skin.
Yeah, Isaac was going to be dead.
Well, that doesn't matter. The point was the skin was supposed to go to the priest.
Yeah.
Then, that's why I tied in.
Well, that's Levitical. I don't know if there would have been quite the same.
With the human sacrifice?
Yeah,
with human.
Well,
it's still a burnt offering.
Abraham did the burnt offering.
Still a burnt offering. But regardless, the whole burnt offering meant that there was nothing left but ashes at the time the burnt offering was done. And then Abraham believed God was going to resurrect him.
Yeah.
So Isaac had to have that same thought. That's my take on it. Because I'm using the typology of what Christ went through, willingly offering his life for the sake of all. And that's the typology that I believe in the scriptures. Sorry I took so long.
Sorry. Hey, raise good questions.
Yeah.
Anytime you raise questions, you spark an interest, and that's a good thing.
Okay, good.
Appreciate it. If nobody has anything to say, they might have slept through the whole thing. That's evidence nobody was sleeping during the talk.
How can you sleep?
All right, we'll come back at 10 minutes, 25 after. 25 after.